Okay, well, obviously, the lives of Samuel, Saul, Jonathan, and David really overlap and intermingle, right? But for the purposes of this two-week study, we'll be trying to focus our attention only on Saul and Jonathan. Now, it's probably quite difficult to consider Saul without at least being reminded of David. And by comparison, Saul will always not just come in second place, but for the most part be David's exact opposite, in a lot of ways anyway, and for good reason. But David aside, we can even judge Saul's beginning as king in light of his end. And for good reason, but I think it's important to consider Saul with a fresh perspective, at least from the beginning. Not in retrospect with how his rule ended, and not in comparison to David, at least not yet. So with that, I'd like to just really quickly review where we've been, and so that we see where we're going here. So following approximately 400 years of judges, in chapter 8 of 1 Samuel, you'll recall that the people demanded to have a king instead of a judge. In fact, all the elders of Israel, as we see in verse 4, came to Samuel to complain to him that they weren't more like the nations around them. And they used Samuel's age and his two corrupt sons as sort of an excuse to replace him with a king. And the Lord, who is never caught off guard by anything or anyone, said to Samuel in verse 7, "Heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them." And Samuel did just that. And as you can see, it involved a whole lot of taking on the part of the king. He will take your sons, he will take your daughters, the best of your fields. He'll take a tenth of your grain, your male servants, female servants, finest young men. He'll take, take, take. That's what a king does. Specifically, this king coming. And Samuel ended by warning that you will be his servants. In verse 18, "And you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day." The people rejected that. Verse 19 says, "Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said no." They didn't just say, "Yeah, yeah, Samuel, we get it, we understand, regardless, give us a king." No, they said, "No, you're wrong, Samuel. No, but we will have a king over us for this purpose, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." So there's really two purposes there. They wanted to be like everybody else. They liked the way it looked. They thought it was cool to have a king. But they also wanted a king to not just judge the nation, but represent them, you know, lead them into war, into fighting their battles for them, in a sense. Okay, so that was the very quick background. Here in chapter 9 is where we're introduced to Saul. And we read in verse 1, "There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, a mighty man of power. And he had a choice and handsome son whose name was Saul. There was not a more handsome person than he among the children of Israel. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people." And I find this personally offensive, but Sam, I think you have proof here that you are in fact the most handsome person in this congregation. So, Steve comes in a close second. Actually, I think your son comes in a close second. He's getting on up there. Yeah. Well, many of us know this story. The family donkeys went missing. Saul and a servant wandered around for a few days, at which point Saul wanted to head back home. They hadn't found the donkeys. But his servant convinced him to seek out the man of God, also known at this time as the seer, in the city that they just happened to be closest to. Just happened to be there. And neither seemed to know that the seer's name was Samuel. In any case, when asked where the seer might be, the girls out by the well, out just outside of the city, were dumbstruck at how lucky Saul and his servant were, because they had just happened to arrive on the very same day that Samuel had, at almost the exact same time. So verse 14, they went up to the city. As they were coming into the city, there was Samuel coming out toward them on his way up to the high place. Now the Lord had told Samuel in his ear the day before Saul came, saying, "Tomorrow about this time I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him commander over my people Israel." So that's why Samuel's coming out. He's obeying the Lord. This is what the Lord told him the day before. And verse 16, "Over my people Israel, that he may save my people from the hand of the Philistines, for I have looked upon my people because their cry has come to me." Wait. Why was the Lord giving them a king? Did you see that? I heard something there. Yes, Israel was sinning in demanding a king at this time, the way they were demanding a king. They were rejecting God's reign. Yet God was faithful. He wasn't vindictive. He wasn't giving them a king for punishment, for purposes of failing. He was giving them a king for the purposes of deliverance from their enemies, that he may save my people from the hand of the Philistines. Why? "For I have looked upon my people because their cry has come to me." Verse 17, "So when Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said to him, 'There he is, the man of whom I spoke to you, this one shall reign over my people.' Then Saul drew near to Samuel in the gate and said, 'Please tell me, where is the seer's house?'" He still doesn't know Samuel is the seer that he's looking for. Verse 19, "Samuel answered Saul and said, 'I am the seer. Go up before me to the high place, for you shall eat with me today, and tomorrow I will let you go and will tell you all that is in your heart.'" That's a lot. Verse 20, "But as for your donkeys that were lost 3 days ago, that you haven't told me about, do not be anxious about them, for they have been found." Well, that's pretty amazing too, right? "And on whom is all the desire of Israel?" What was Israel's desire? A king. They wanted a king. "Is it not on you and on all your father's house?" Well, that would just blow Saul's mind right there. Now, verse 21, Saul answered in shock and said, "Am I not a Benjamite, of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then do you speak like this to me?" And it continues here. Samuel took Saul and his servant, brought them into the hall where the feast was, had them sit in the place of honor among those who were invited. There were about 30 persons. And Samuel said to the cook, "Bring the portion which I gave you, of which I said to you, 'Set it apart.'" This is the best part, for the honored guest. So the cook took up the thigh with its upper part and set it before Saul. And Samuel said, "Here it is. What was kept back, it was set apart for you. Eat, for until this time it has been kept for you since I said I invited the people." So, you know, Samuel's faith is really something here, isn't it? It's amazing to watch this. But the timing here is just remarkable. It fully demonstrates God's involvement in the selection of Saul. God had revealed to Samuel way back in chapter 8 that he would give a king to Israel. Then he led Saul and his servant by means of 3 days' worth of, you know, circumstances, all because of lost donkeys, to the very place where Samuel would be, and to the very feast at which Saul was to be the guest of honor. He was expected by Samuel because God had told him the day prior to expect the future king to start, you know, just to walk into town looking for him. And so Samuel had prepared for him in advance. Though he didn't even know his name or what he would look like, he was preparing for him because God told him. And so Saul, you know, on the other hand, he didn't even know he was invited. He wasn't going into town to go to a feast. What an amazing coincidence, right? Yeah. No, not at all. God was very much involved in this. And so the next day, Samuel anointed Saul and said to him, "Tell the servant to go on ahead of us." And he went on, "But you stand here a while that I may announce to you the word of God." And every indication here is that Saul received the word of God spoken to him by Samuel, and meaning that he believed it. he trusted in the word of the Lord here. And verse 1 we read, "Then Samuel took a flask of oil and poured it on his head and kissed him and said, 'Is it not because the Lord has anointed you commander over his inheritance?'" And so at this point, Samuel gave Saul three signs to confirm to him that he was indeed appointed by God. He had been chosen by God for this purpose, to be Israel's king. And the last of these signs is here in verse 5, that you will meet a group of prophets coming down from the high place with all these instruments. They'll be prophesying. Verse 6, "Then the Spirit of the Lord will come upon you, and you will prophesy with them and be turned into another man. And let it be, when these signs come to you, that you do as the occasion demands." Why? "For God is with you." These were, in effect, Saul's marching orders right here. Verse 8, "You shall go down before me to Gilgal, and surely I will come down to you to offer burnt offerings and make sacrifices of peace offerings. 7 days you shall wait till I come to you and show you what you should do." Verse 9, "So it was when he had turned his back to go from Samuel that God gave him another heart. And this to me is evidence that Saul believed what had been spoken to him." He believed what Samuel had just revealed to him. You may disagree with that. That's fine. Let's keep reading. Verse 10, "When they came there to the hill, there was a group of prophets to meet him. Then the Spirit of God came upon him, and he prophesied among them. And it happened when all who knew him formerly saw that he indeed prophesied among the prophets, that the people said to one another, 'What is this that has come upon the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets?'" Obviously, a sign here meant not just for Saul, but to be publicly witnessed and acknowledged as significant. This divine act of God intended as a public demonstration that God had empowered this man to judge and rule the nation. Now, what we just read here, the Spirit came upon him and he prophesied, this shouldn't be considered lightly. You know, we shouldn't just brush over this. Or, as is often the case, you know, attempts made to explain this away later on when Saul self-destructs, which, by the way, you're not supposed to be thinking of. You're supposed to be thinking of Saul, you know, from a fresh perspective right now. But what I want you to see here is that Saul is presented as a believer. Consider that Saul was the Lord's choice for Israel. He was divinely appointed to reign. He was divinely changed, transformed by God specifically for this appointment. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and this is a big one. This can only be said of believers. Why do I say that? Because God can have no fellowship with unbelievers, meaning that he cannot work cooperatively with an unbeliever, or perhaps it's the other way around. An unbeliever has no spiritual capacity to work cooperatively with God. Yes, the Lord can and does use unbelievers. He uses them as tools. But that is much different than working together with the Lord. And we'll see that Saul does, in fact, work in concert with the Spirit of the Lord, albeit briefly. Now, we'll be able to add to this list a couple of points later on as we move along, but for now, let's keep moving. Now, following the prophecy sign, there was a public designation of Saul as king, and this is when Samuel assembled all of Israel, and as prophet, as representative of God, there he identified Saul as the man God had appointed as to serve as king. And we read in verse 23, chapter 10, "So they ran and brought him from there." This is when Saul was hiding in the luggage or baggage or whatever. "And when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. And Samuel said to all the people, 'Do you see him whom the Lord has chosen? That there is no one like him among all the people.' So all the people shouted and said, 'Long live the king.'" Now, isn't that interesting? It says that the Lord has chosen him. Back in chapter 8, when Samuel warned the people, he said, "You will cry out because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves." That's curious. Well, let's think about that as we move on. Now, chapter 11 tells of Nahash and the Ammonites. think this was the original heavy metal band, Nahash and the Ammonites. It sounds like a rock band, doesn't it? Nahash, the Ammonite, who came up and encamped against the Israelite city of Jabesh-Gilead. And so in order to stave off impending mass death and destruction, the people of this city offered to surrender themselves to the enemy and offered to be servants. And this is never a good idea. And here Nahash illustrates that because he said, sure, that's fine. I'm still going to put everybody's right eyes out. Okay? Just so you know. So the people of the city sent out for messengers. They sent messengers out to seek help from among everyone else, you know, from among their brethren. In verse 4, we read about these messengers. They came to Gibeah of Saul and told the news in the hearing of the people, and all the people lifted up their voices and wept. Verse 5, now there was Saul coming behind the herd from the field, and Saul said, what troubles the people that they weep? And they told him the words of the men of Jabesh. Then the Spirit of God came upon Saul when he heard this news, and his anger was greatly aroused. And I feel like I have to pause here because while much anger is ungodly, most anger is in our day. I just had some ungodly anger yesterday. Saul should have gotten angry here. You know, there are times when believers ought to be angry and they don't get angry. For example, when Jesus in the temple, he overturned the tables of the money changers. He actually made a whip out of cords to whip the thieves and their animals out of the temple courts. That was obviously, by definition, godly anger. In this case, Saul became angry when he heard of this news because he was walking in the Spirit. When he heard the news, the Spirit of God came upon him and moved him to act. And because he was trusting that God was with him, remember his marching orders, God was with him, he did exactly as the occasion demanded, empowered by the Holy Spirit to do so. Very similar, in fact, to what we read about of Samson just a few weeks ago. Recall how the Spirit of the Lord had come upon him in his anger for the very purpose of slaughtering the enemy. That's how God was working with these men to drive the enemy out of their land. And so I missed a verse there, verse 7. So he took a yoke of oxen, Saul did, and cut them in pieces and sent them throughout all the territory of Israel by the hands of messengers, saying, whoever does not go out with Saul and Samuel to battle, so it shall be done to his oxen. And the fear of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out with one consent. They were united in this. In fact, 330,000 of the people came out with one consent. And they killed Ammonites for most of the next day. Verse 12, then the people said to Samuel, who is he who said, shall Saul reign over us? Bring the men that we may put them to death. And we skipped over this part earlier, but there had been those who questioned the selection of Saul. They doubted Saul. They doubted God in choosing or in appointing Saul as king. And now as a result of this victory, the people wanted those guys put to death. And notice that within that statement, who are they trusting in? They're attributing their victory not to God, but to Saul's leadership. So they're still looking to be saved by a human king here, rather than by the Lord. But Saul actually corrects them here. And we need to really pay attention to this because this is the last time he gets things right. Verse 13, but Saul said, not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has accomplished salvation in Israel. Then Samuel said to the people, come, let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there. So all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. There they made sacrifices of peace offerings before the Lord. And there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. And there's something we should add to our list, by the way. Saul worshipped. On a couple of occasions, Saul is said to have legitimately worshipped the Lord. And this, again, can only be said of believers, because only believers have a relationship with him in order to worship him. Of course, we need to be in fellowship to do so, but nevertheless, only believers can legitimately worship. Okay, well, This was Saul's crowning moment, ironically, just before he's crowned as king. But we read here, actually, let's review. So the people had rejected having God as their king, right? They demanded a human king so that they could be more like all the nations. They were reminded that they themselves had chosen this king. By the way, was God caught off guard by this? No, of course not. 400 years earlier, in fact, he had said in Deuteronomy 17, verse 14, "When you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you, and possess it and dwell in it, and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me." It's like a direct quote, isn't it? Only 400 years earlier. "You shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses." Right? So no, he wasn't caught off guard by their sinful demand. In fact, he had actually prepared for this very thing. And he was active in the selection of Saul. Saul was a gracious gift of God to his people. Why do I say that? Well, in spite of their sinful demand, God gave Saul to Israel as her king out of mercy and compassion. Why? Because he had heard their cries for rescue. That's why he gave them the king. And he had sent Saul, just as he had done in times past with Moses and the Exodus, with all the judges before Saul, including Samuel. All through that time, he had sent deliverers, and Saul is the next deliverer here, to deliver his people from the hand of the enemy. Saul was not given to Israel because God wanted him to fail. He did provide a physically superior man whose outward appearance and stature were exactly what the people wanted in a king. They desired it. So God very much gave them the man they most wanted. That's true. The king they most desired. Nevertheless, God empowered Saul, putting his spirit upon him to enable him to rule in the proper way. When Saul walked in the Spirit, God moved him into action and used him to deliver the people. When he walked in the Spirit, he recognized that the victory was God's victory, not his own. He was a man marked by humility and grace even. And wouldn't it be nice if for Saul's sake this was the end of the story? Unfortunately, it's really just the beginning. So in chapter 12, verse 13, while still at Gilgal here, Samuel delivered the keynote address at Saul's coronation. And he said, "Now therefore, here is the king whom you have chosen and whom you have desired. And take note, the Lord has set a king over you." Notice the if-then statement here. Verse 14, "If you fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and do not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then both you and the king who reigns over you will continue following the Lord your God. However, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you as it was against your fathers. And do not turn aside, for then you would go after empty things which cannot profit or deliver, such as putting your faith in a human king. Only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, you shall be swept away, both you and your king." Ominous words, right? But notice who's being held responsible here. Is it just Saul? Not really. The nation, right? Not just Saul. Now, the story continues in chapter 13. And let's just read from 1. "And when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, Saul chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel. 2,000 were with Saul in Michmashan in the mountains of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin. The rest of the people he sent away, every man to his tent." So, that volunteer army of 330,000... Saul only kept a standing army of 3,000. I don't know why. How long had Saul been reigning? 2 years. What had he been doing in that amount of time? Evidently nothing. He's done nothing. Recall that when Israel moved in to liberate the promised land from, you know, the idolaters, the heathen, They were to take full control over it. That was their God-given mission, to do that very thing. Of course, due to sin, they never quite finished that task. And of course, then we had the 400 years of ups and downs, of judges, of liberation and oppression. And Samuel was that last judge. Saul is the first king. That king who had been God-enabled, God-empowered, God-directed to do what the occasion demanded should not have been content with garrisons of enemy troops in his land. Not just occupying the land belonging to Israel, but oppressing the people as well. Remember, God had given them a king in order to deliver them. And that's what the people expected as well. But here it had been 2 years, and Saul seemed content to just leave well enough alone. Though he received no rebuke for this, I can't look at this as anything other than disobedience. And disobedience, continual disobedience, over a 2 year stretch. A dereliction of duty, if you will. Saul had had an army of 330,000. And with Philistine garrisons stationed here and there and everywhere, he was apparently unwilling to do anything about that. Saul was unwilling, but Jonathan, his son, was more than willing, which will begin to show a great contrast between Saul and his son Jonathan. Verse 3, chapter 13, "And Jonathan attacked the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. Then Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, 'Let the Hebrews hear.' Now all Israel heard it said that Saul had attacked a garrison of the Philistines, and that Israel had also become an abomination to the Philistines, and the people were called together to Saul at Gilgal." Now, unlike his father, Jonathan was willing to do what the occasion demanded. He was tired of waiting. He had waited 2 years for this. And his action here had brought things to a head, of course. In response, the Philistines organized this massive counterattack. Saul couldn't do anything other than assemble the nation for war. His hand had been forced. But notice the situation is very different than what it was 2 years before with the Ammonites. Earlier, Saul had been empowered by the Holy Spirit. Here, there's no mention of the Spirit of the Lord. Why? Because of 2 years of disobedience. Earlier, because Saul had been walking in the Spirit, godly anger motivated him to assemble all the people in a way that really got their attention. Here, he was basically forced into doing something he didn't really want to do. And people can see that. People know if their leader just kind of, you know, doesn't really want to do it, but okay, I guess I have to do it anyway. Earlier, as a result of Saul's action, as a result of his eagerness to confront the enemy, we read that the fear of the Lord fell on the people and they came out with one consent. 330,000, in fact. Contrary to that, we read here in chapter 13 that the people were distressed. Many were scattered, hid in caves and thickets and rocks and holes and pits. And really, only 600 people stayed, and they were trembling with fear. There was a serious problem with leadership here. There was a serious problem among the people as well. Why were they so distressed? Who were they trusting in? Their king, instead of the Lord. They were trusting in their king and not fearing the Lord. Now, verse 7, "As for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. Then he waited 7 days, according to the time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him," Saul. "So Saul said, 'Bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me.' And he offered the burnt offering. Now it happened, as soon as he had finished presenting the burnt offering, that Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him, that he might greet him. And Samuel said, 'What have you done?' Saul said, 'When I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that you did not come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, then I said, the Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal, and I have not made supplication to the Lord. Therefore I felt compelled and offered a burnt offering.'" That's quite a justification. Me. That's the I factor. Saul spoke of himself as if the the success of this battle depended on him. And then he blamed it on Samuel for not showing up when Saul wanted him to. It was supreme arrogance. He had been a humble man just 2 years earlier. But that had apparently changed. As further evidence, Samuel rebuked him, and Saul didn't really even seem to care. I mean, he was aware of his sin, because as soon as Samuel showed up, he was trying to justify it. But he certainly is not presented here as being repentant in any way. Verse 13, Samuel said to Saul, "You have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever, but now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." Wow, so Saul really blew it. But again, I feel compelled to reiterate what Samuel had said at Saul's coronation, where he said, "If you, the people, fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and do not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then both you, the people, and the king who reigns over you will continue following the Lord your God." Obviously, the king was not continuing to follow the Lord. So what does that mean about the people as well? Yeah, well, in any case, Saul waited the appointed time, almost. But as that seventh day was drawn to an end, perhaps the sun was getting lower in the sky. Not quite sunset, but close. Saul decided it had been long enough. After all, it's basically been 7 full days. Danger is imminent. The soldiers continue to scatter and hide. Those that are with me are all trembling with fear. This is crazy. This is urgent. Where is that Samuel? Man, I guess I have to do everything myself. I am king. So he took matters into his own hands, right? Now, some might be tempted to say that Saul's actions were almost understandable. That, possibly God's response through Samuel is a little too harsh. I'm sure none of us would be tempted to think that. But it wasn't just a matter of Saul being impatient, of not waiting quite long enough, right? Because Saul surely knew what every other Israelite knew, that according to the law, only the priests were to administer and carry out sacrifices. Yes, the individual bringing the sacrifice was oftentimes very much involved in that, required to be even involved in the killing of the animal. But the priests were charged with offering the blood, with burning the various pieces of the sacrifice on the altar. That was for the priest and the priest alone, as prescribed by the law. That's one. In addition to that, remember also what God had originally commanded them. Just as they were on the verge of going into the promised land, he said, "Also it shall be when he, the king, sits on the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priests, the Levites, and it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that, for this purpose, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God and be careful to observe some, all the words of this law and these statutes." Why? "That his heart may not be lifted above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, and ultimately that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel." The law, including the Levitical sacrifices, that system, was to be the king's constant guide. He was to read and reread it every day. By it, he would learn to fear the Lord. And he would keep himself from getting puffed up, puffed up with pride and elevating himself above his brethren, even the priests, right? And so this was a command specifically to the king, and an important one, so much so that obedience to it was associated with the longevity of his kingdom, the longevity of his days and that of his children's in the kingdom. Now, on top of all of that, that's two reasons. Saul had the very clear, specific instructions from Samuel about how long to wait for him, right? So he had disobeyed the law. He did not heed the instructions given to kings, of which he was the very first one. You would think that he would obey that. And he had rejected the specific commandment of the Lord given him through Samuel. This was defiant rebellion. You can't call it anything else. Saul had absolutely no excuse. And I'm reminded of the proverb, pride goes before destruction. A haughty spirit before the fall. His was not, this was not humility by any means. So the result of his disobedience here, his descendants would not reign after him. Very much in line with that last part of Deuteronomy 17, verse 20. His dynasty was coming to an end. And in fact, God had already chosen another king that after Saul's reign came to an end, that other king would come into the picture. A man after God's own heart. Please don't conclude that God wanted Saul to fail. It's really difficult to look at that and come away with that conclusion. God had given Israel the king they desired, yes, but he didn't give them a king in order to fail. The failures of Saul were not due to God's undermining or pulling the strings, but to Saul's personal failure to walk in the ways of God. In his failure to trust and obey God, he knew all this. He knew all of it. He chose not to do it. Saul failed to appropriate the resources God had given him in order to rule effectively. Now, chapter 13 is really the fallout from this. And so we see that Samuel had left without showing Saul what he should do. The Lord wouldn't provide guidance to Saul, though he might ask for it. He was in a state of willful disobedience. And this reminds me of James chapter 4. You ask and do not receive because you ask amiss. That's where Saul is here. Saul is without guidance, even though he wants it. And the situation, at least in human terms, is insurmountable. It's just, he's got 600 men trembling in fear. The enemy has an army as the sand which is on the seashore. The enemy has all kinds of weapons, spears, swords. The Israelites had farming equipment. And so, Saul is just paralyzed, unwilling and unable to make a move. But if he wouldn't take initiative, guess who would? Again. Verse 1 of chapter 14. Now it happened one day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who bore his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side." But he did not tell his father. And Saul was sitting in the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men. What a contrast! you got one guy, he's going into battle with one companion. The other is sitting under a tree surrounded by 600 trembling soldiers. Who was doing as the occasion demanded here? Who was trusting in the Lord? Verse 6, then Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few." So his armor bearer said to him, "Do all that is in your heart. Go then, here I am with you according to your heart." And there's a contrast there too. Just seeing Jonathan's faith in action, this one guy is set apart from all those other people who are trembling in fear, following a fearful king as well. Verse 8, then Jonathan said, "Very well, let us cross over to these men and we will show ourselves to them. If they say thus to us, wait until we come to you, then we'll stand still in our place and not go up to them. But if they say thus, come up to us, then we will go up, for the Lord has delivered them into our hand, and this will be a sign to us." And that's all the guidance Jonathan needed. So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines, and the Philistines said, "Look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they've hidden." Then the men of the garrison called to Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, "Come up to us and we will show you something." Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Come up after me, for the Lord has delivered them into the hand of Israel." And Jonathan climbed up on his hands and knees with his armor bearer after him. And they, the Philistines, fell before Jonathan, and as he came after him, his armor bearer killed them. That first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within about half an acre of land. So Jonathan's faith in action resulted in the death of 20 enemies here within the space of a half acre. Pretty close quarter combat. And it really kick-started this battle because at this point, the Lord divinely intervened with a great earthquake. It was a targeted earthquake that caused massive panic and confusion in just the camp of the Philistines. Isn't that amazing? And it resulted in friendly fire chaos. You know, swords were pointing in all different directions, and men were falling against each other's swords. And so what we see here is despite Saul's faithlessness, God reassembled Israel for battle in order to save them. And eventually Saul turned his soldiers loose to give chase. But just before he did, he issued an edict to all his troops to make sure that the killing was good. He said, "Cursed is the man who eats any food until evening, before I have taken vengeance on my enemies." Funny, you know, he had been too scared to make a move until Jonathan forced him into it again. Only then did he issue this oath. Also notice the I factor makes an appearance again. Saul had become so supremely arrogant that he was trying to gain credit for what looked to be an amazing, decisive victory now. Trying to make this all about him. No. Eating will take far too long. I must have vengeance on my enemies right now. Really? What about the last 2 years, Saul? So he's totally self-serving and foolish as well, because as the battle shifted, the Israelites were forced to chase the enemy over about 20 miles of rocky, mountainous terrain. And all because of Saul's command, they were forced to do it without any energy. Initially, it caused them to be distressed due to hunger, and all the more when they came across this honey in the woods. But they didn't eat, because even though it wouldn't have wasted any time, they didn't eat because they feared what Saul would do to them. Jonathan, of course, was unaware of this edict by his father because he was the one leading the charge. He was out there fighting already. He hadn't been waiting on Saul to get out from under his pomegranate tree. And when he found out about this oath, he said, "My father has troubled the land. How much better if the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found. For now, would there not have been a much greater slaughter among the Philistines?" So Saul's oath actually resulted in the exact opposite of what he intended. And actually, it ended up much worse than that, because as it turned out, it resulted in the people breaking the Lord's commandment in order to keep Saul's commandment. When they came to what had been a Philistine stronghold, we read that the people were very faint, and the people rushed on the spoil and took sheep, oxen, and calves, and slaughtered them on the ground, and the people ate them with the blood. It's pretty gross. But this was in direct violation of the law, which stated that blood was never to be eaten, and for good reason. That's Leviticus chapter 17. We won't read that. When Saul found out, he self-righteously accused the people, "You have dealt treacherously." It's funny. I wonder if they had been doing this if it hadn't been for Saul's commandment. They were acting like vampires because of him. So Saul built an altar to the Lord, not for worship, not to seek the Lord or his guidance, but to accommodate the people's extreme bloodthirsty hunger that he had brought about. And so I have to ask, how much longer did this take than eating a little bit of honey in the woods? To slaughter all those animals one by one, to prepare them in just the right prescribed manner according to law, how much longer did that take than if the people had just eaten freely of the spoils of war? Finally, this episode of the story concludes with the priest urging Saul to draw near to God in order to learn whether or not they should continue on after the Philistines. And again, James 4 comes to mind here. "You ask and do not receive." The Lord did not answer Saul that day. Why? Well, let's review. Consider that the entire episode began with Saul arrogantly making the communal sacrifices himself. It was fake worship. He was approaching God in the wrong way, with the wrong attitude. Therefore, Samuel did not show him what he should do. So apart from the Lord's guidance, what did Saul do? Did he consult with the priest that was with him, who was in full priestly garb? Nope. He sat down under a tree. Meanwhile, unlike his father, Jonathan had received God's direction because he had sought it out by faith. And the resulting earthquake should have been clear direction to Saul and everybody else to get busy killing Philistines, but apparently it wasn't clear enough for Saul, at least not to begin with, because that was when he did decide to inquire of the Lord through the priest in some strange, probably superstitious ritual involving the Ark of the Covenant. We didn't read that part, by the way. You might be wondering if you, you know, took a nap then. I had skipped over that part. But just as soon as he had begun this ritual, Saul put it to an end. He said, withdraw your hand. And now we've just seen that Saul had built an altar to the Lord, but didn't once seek the Lord or his guidance in that process. Plenty of missed opportunities to receive guidance from God. So why would God answer him now? Well, he didn't. Imagine that. And so when that happened, Saul assumed that it was because of someone's sin. Someone must have sinned. But rather than understanding it had something to do with maybe his own sin or the sin of his soldiers who had eaten, you know, blood, he jumped to the conclusion that it had to be the sin of someone violating his order not to eat. And that guilty party was obviously deserving of death. So in Saul's mind, whose commandment carried more weight? He's really setting himself against God at this point. His edict deserved death. The Lord's commandment not to eat blood, let's build an altar and that'll, you know, appease God. He won't get mad. So, through a very brief, very, very brief process of casting lots, Jonathan is identified as the perpetrator who had tasted honey that was forbidden, that he didn't even know was forbidden. Actually, it seems evident that Saul knew Jonathan had been the one to break his edict even before the lot was cast, which makes the casting of lots here, especially the way Saul did it, a charade. He was manipulating the situation in order to have an excuse to kill his own son. That troublemaking son of mine who's always causing strife with the enemy and going off half-cocked without talking to me first about it, making me look like a fool. I've had enough of that. I think it's significant that we see Saul's tendency to manipulate and kill even his own son. And in this case, someone very much like David. But Saul was willing to do this even before the distressing spirit came upon him. Which, by the way, you're not supposed to be thinking about because we're not there yet. Okay, now, so the foolishness of his father was quite apparent to Jonathan. Nevertheless, he was respectful to Saul as father and king. He didn't make excuses. He didn't criticize his father in front of everyone. He accepted it. He said, I only tasted a little honey with the end of the rod that was in my hand, so now I must die. He was willing to die, just as if he was in battle. And Saul seemed eager to put him to death. He wanted to. God do so and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan. Not, oh, well, you didn't know about it, so, yeah. Just don't do it next time, Jonathan. No, he's ready to kill him for no good reason. But the people wouldn't allow it. They said, shall Jonathan die, who has accomplished this great deliverance in Israel? Certainly not. As the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day, cooperatively. They had it exactly right. Though it could have been a much greater victory, the deliverance accomplished in Israel wasn't as a result of Saul. but as a direct result of Jonathan's faith and his initiative. Jonathan worked with God by his faith, and deliverance was accomplished in spite of a jealous Saul. And I've already gone well over, so we should stop right there. Sorry that took so long. But that's a good stopping point, and we'll pick it up from there next week.